Oh, hello, how are you doing? One of your hosts here, Kyle. Before we get into the episode, just wanted to ask if you had been listening to the podcast at all. Me and Tim have been told that it helps if you rate or review the show on whatever platform you listen to it on. Me and Tim are pretty terrible at promoting, so we tend to forget to mention it during episodes. So just wanted to take a quick second before the show to ask that. Also, sharing the show, letting others know about it helps, or reaching out to us at our Twitter at @pages_panels. Again, it just helps us out, mainly to get other guests on the show. Again, every episode is a creator, so we're always reaching out to people, and it helps if we can show them that we have a good rating and people are listening. But thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to George's Dog Days of Bummer. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle, and joined by the other Lopez lover, my co-host, Tim Adore. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Celebrating my birthday in quarantine.
So that's especially... I don't think I've discussed it, and I don't want to get off to a topic, but are you... Do you live with your girlfriend, or does she come visit?
She comes and visits.
Are you allowing her in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, as long as she keeps herself safe. She knows the rules.
Doesn't travel out of the country and come back.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately for your birthday, we won't be able to talk about the episode of George Lopez when Benny seems depressed that her belongings had burned down in a fire, so George wants to get her a companion for his depressed mother. We actually have a really good episode, so that might be good for your birthday. We're going to talk to creator Von Allen about his work in comics. God, I hate every time we're going to do this. So first, I'll introduce Von. How you doing, Von?
I'm doing really good. Hi, everybody.
So, yeah, I mean, we'll jump right into it, because I'm interested. So, briefly, before we were talking about Comicsology, so congratulations, obviously, Wolfside coming out on Comicsology on the 22nd when we're recording this. And you had mentioned, like, you had been working on this for a while and originally kind of were looking at a print release, and then as things have, you know, just... crumbled around the world in approach Comicsology. One of the things I'm always interested in is they have the guided view. Is that something you have to take into account now when you're kind of rushing to get it on to Comicsology? Because I've heard in the past sometimes like you have no say in what the guided view happens, and sometimes you can kind of have a little bit of say. I mean, how does that work for you as a creator?
As far as I know, and I mean, maybe this is different for other people, in Comicsology's sort of PDF creation guidelines, they have minimum resolution requirements for the PDF, so like purely DPI. And if you are under it, I gather it's not at a high res, it's like the images won't be high res enough to work with guided view. So sort of one of the first things you have to do is if you want to do guided view, which I absolutely wanted to do, you have to make sure you're hitting that minimum benchmark first and you know, sort of using the rest of their specs as you go. So as long as you do that, or at least in my case, because again, it's a unique process, so I have no idea if there are, you know, for like larger publishers or something like that, if it works a bit differently. But in my case, I've never had to request it or ask for it or anything like that. It's always been automatic with my stuff, and that seems to be the case with Wolfshead so far too.
So, and I mean, for that kind of dropping the first issue, and again, you've kind of had it available before, but now kind of getting it to, I guess, a larger audience. I mean, what is, I guess, we'll do the quick interviewee question I normally try to avoid, but what is Wolfshead, I guess?
Okay, so Wolf Said's a story. It's set in the real world, and it's about a young woman named Lauren Green who sort of living her day-to-day life, and she's struggling. She used to be a cop, and she decided to get out of that for all kinds of reasons. And she's basically trying to make ends meet. And it turns out that her mom basically is working at a, like, she's a janitor at a corporation, and this corporation has sort of made the singularity breakthrough and has created this sort of new artificial intelligence. They had planned, the corporation had planned to use it for war and to use it to, like, it's kind of the, Terminator Dark Future kind of idea, and the AI didn't want to do it. And I thought part of the, the fun of the story would be to create, we always get these sort of post-apocalyptic artificial intelligence stories, and I wanted to sort of upend that and do it from, hey, this is an artificial intelligence that's empathic and smart and likes people and whatnot. And through the help of Lauren's mom, it actually breaks out of the corporation and sort of goes out into the world on its own. And when Lauren finds out, she's kind of fascinated and horrified all at the same time that her mom is sort of helping this creature, this thing, do this. And Lauren sort of gets the, like, understands the consequences of the potential ramifications of what her mom has done. But a lot of the sort of the fun of the story for me and the adventure of the story, I kind of view it as like an action adventure story with some sci-fi elements, is, the consequences of what Patty, Lauren's mom, had done, and then, how Lauren tries to process it at the same time, trying to make rent and trying to buy groceries and whatnot. So it's the kind of story I like to tell, because I've always sort of been drawn to comics and superheroes and what have you that are kind of grounded in reality, and I tried very hard to do that with the story. So yeah, I'm having a blast with it.
Yeah, and I love the idea, even just to approach the AI, because like I think, like you said, normally we see Terminator or even I think of recently like Ultron. Like the second AI gets sentience, it sees humans as the problem, and that it, like Wolf says, a more I guess optimistic approach. Like if it was actually like I mean, a lot of people, I think generally we see the good in humanity, where the whether it be small or just confined, the most relatable thing. So to have an AI that you think could obviously possibly do that from the human experience is really interesting on its own.
Yeah, I think so too. And for me, like, I have so little interest. And I mean, it's not to say that it can't be done well when you're doing sort of the post-apocalyptic or dark sort of side, but it has become a cliche, and I like trying to avoid cliches in my work as much as I can, at least the ones I'm aware of. It's hard to, you try to be cognizant of everything, but it's always, maybe something creeps in. But in this case, right off the bat, when I was initially coming up with the story, I really wanted to invert that kind of cliche and just go with, basically an artificial intelligence that likes people, likes, sort of loves the world, and is curious about it. And I thought that would be, there's a lot of narrative and story potential, I think, in that kind of sort of angle on a on an artificial intelligence. And so far, at least, it's been going pretty well.
I think another interesting aspect to this series is kind of your approach to the leads. And again, centering it on two female leads and obviously two minority leads. Is that difficult for you to kind of approach that in your voice and kind of create the characters for them and kind of get this unique and accurate voice to these female leads?
It's always a tough, like, it's a tough question to answer, because like the flip side of me wants to sort of go, no, it's fairly straightforward. But I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't say it wasn't in the back of my mind. And my feeling with it was, when I was originally coming up with it, with Wolf's Head, sort of with the this brainstorming idea, I tend to view things like what is pretty typical and what have we seen a lot of. So I, obviously with comics we see a lot of white guys sort of in lead roles, and that's, it's understandable. It's I don't really have a problem with that in and of itself. But when you start asking questions like, for this new story that nobody has read before, like, why can't a main character be black, or why can't a main character be female, or what have you. When you start sort of angling your characters from that point of view and sort of grounding it in questions like that, it leads to interesting possibilities, and it leads, at least for me, it leads to interesting sort of creative challenges. So my feeling was, I think representation matters still, I really do. And I wanted to do a story that was different. And in the same way that the artificial intelligence was different, I wanted the main characters of the story to be a little bit different. And it was also, you know, part of the reason why I went for like a mom-daughter dynamic rather than two friends or two, you know, just two young people or whatever, is I wanted to play around with, you know, sort of the family relationships as well, and just see where it takes me. And, you know, I, at least the feedback so far, and I mean, it's tricky because it's not like it's, you know, loads and loads of people have read it, but enough people have read it that the feedback, you know, has been pretty strong. I haven't had anybody sort of slapping me down for, you know, bad representation or for, you know, using stereotypes in a bad way or anything like that. I mean, it could still happen. I mean, you know, you'll piss off somebody eventually, but so far, at least, so good.
Right, yeah, and I enjoy, and I mean, again, writing the relationship between the two, I think I really enjoyed, and that obviously comes from just having a relationship in general with people. I think being able to write that and make it feel genuine, but I enjoy, like you said, kind of, I think generally is if you, you know, if you're to approach a comic and say, like, as me as a white male, write a comic with, you know, a cast of white males, it's so easy to then have those, all those voices bleed together, because you're not really, I guess, pushing yourself, or at least, you know, often they come across as the same voice. Whereas if you approach a character, even just, you know, changing something up or forcing yourself to view things from a different angle or be empathetic to something else, like, at least then, you know, you're kind of, you know, challenging your own voice and pushing it to a different character. Or if you're pushing your voice to another character, it at least gives a you know, change to kind of just the same narrative vocally over and over again.
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of the things, like, when you can do it well, and I always have to be careful because I don't want to say necessarily that I think I'm, you know, brilliant or anything like that, but when it's going well, like, you're asking questions constantly when you're writing and you're brainstorming, and, you know, a lot of things on the lines of, you know, what does this character want? What are they trying to accomplish? What are the obstacles that are sort of preventing them from getting it? What do they do to try to get around those obstacles? And then what's kind of fun from, like, from a writing creativity point of view is when you have different characters that are strong, that all have different goals and motivations and then different obstacles, and how do those things all mesh together? And I find that, like, that's a lot of fun on the writing side to play around with, is to, you know, try to figure out what, you know, what these characters want, and then what happens when some of their own goals and obstacles clash with one another. And what I feel, and again, this is just me, but what I feel is that allows you immediately, particularly when you're dealing with protagonists, you get around sort of the, well, they fight, or, well, they're going to punch each other. You know, it's like, well, they're not going to do that. So how do they kind of work this out? And sometimes they argue, and sometimes they come to understandings, and there's communication, and there's, you know, sort of hiccups and, you know, false starts and reversals along the way. And that's fun. Hopefully, and I, again, it's really difficult for me to judge it, but hopefully it keeps the narrative, you know, fresh and exciting, and it keeps the reader hopefully not quite knowing what's going to happen next, so it keeps them excited and hopefully keeps them coming back for more.
So Wolf's Head is a completely kind of different style of work from your previous work, like The Road to God Knows.
Yeah.
So was it a conscious decision to do something kind of a complete 180 away?
It's tricky because I knew I wanted to do a series, and I've been wanting to do a series for a long time. The problem was, I also knew, particularly on the visual arts side, I wasn't strong enough. So my whole art career and comics career has been learning by doing and falling on my face a lot. And one of the fun things I did in sort of the back pages, you know, which you guys saw of Wolf's Head, is putting some of the side-by-side comparisons of early, you know, what was published with Wolf, with The Road to God Knows, and then some of the corrections I did for this documentary I'm in. And it's been frustrating, you know, it can be exciting. It in some ways it's exhilarating, you know, but at the same time, I found it truly discouraging, and it's really hard to in language to express that properly, of the ideas in my head I couldn't execute very well. And, you know, you sort of constantly are, like in my case, you know, trying to draw something and being like, well, it's not great, but I guess it'll do, or that's the best I can do right now. And oftentimes, one of the things I ran into is, you know, you think what you've done, you know, particularly for Road, I thought it was okay, particularly coming from like the indie comic sort of punk do-it-yourself aesthetic that I came out of. And then be like, wow, people are kind of brutal about it, you know, people are kind of harsh about it, and I'm not even seeing it. And then sort of, you know, a couple of years go by, and then I pull it back out and see like, wow, yeah, I've actually, that was pretty terrible. How come I didn't see that before? You know, it's a weird, again, it's hard to put into words, but it was a weird process to go through. So with Wolf's Head, you know, part of it was I wanted to show, you know, I wanted to do like this, a longer form story that wasn't like a graphic novel, which I had done before, and sort of, you know, a beginning, middle, end story. I wanted to do something ongoing. And I also wanted to push myself. I wanted to see, hey, in a serialized story that, you know, is ongoing, what can I do? How can I challenge myself? How can I play with it? And honestly, I also have pretty strong opinions of what I think periodical comics can be, and what I think often are not, you know, typically on a comic book store's shelves right now. So I wanted to see if some of my own ideas, you know, it's a little bit like, well, put your money where your mouth is. If you think, you know, if you're a big talker, you think you've got opinions, okay, fine, let's go see what you can do. Can you try it and see how far you can get? And so there's been a lot of challenges with Wolf's Head, just on the both on the writing side and on the visual art side, because I'm using in Wolf's Head far more 9-panel, even 12-panel, sometimes 16-panel pages than I had ever done before. And, you know, basically to see in a 20-page, 22-page type story how much content you can get in there without, like, making it so burdensome or so text-heavy that it's unreadable. And I actually went back. I did some comparisons with 60s comics, particularly Marvel Silver Age stuff, just looking not so much at like the narratives, but actually looking at just questions around the amount of panels that guys like Steve Ditko would do when he was laying out like a Spider-Man or a Doctor Strange story or whatever, and then also how many words per panel, how many balloons per panel, how many words per page would somebody like Stan Lee actually use. And then I compared it to more contemporary comics, and I was just blown away. Like, it's not unheard of. I mean, Stan Lee, you know, regardless of the falling out he had, and, you know, sort of the credit issues with people like Ditko and Jack Kirby and whatnot, I mean, you pick up an early issue of Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, and there's like 200 words per page, and oftentimes 7 to 9 panels. It's astounding compared to contemporary comics where, you know, I was looking at things that had like, you know, 63 words per page and far fewer panels. So when people talk about, you know, writing for the trade, or, you know, why buy the periodical anymore? Why you should just buy the graphic novel because there's more story. There's actually, and like, it wasn't scientific or anything like that, but in my little back of the envelope calculations that I did, there actually is something to that. And I wanted to see with Wolf's Head if I could actually sort of challenge it, not in an old-fashioned way, not in like a retro way, but just sort of go, hey, there's room for more text than oftentimes people do it. And it, the story, like the artwork, doesn't get cramped. It still breathes, at least I think so. And you can get more story in an individual issue than I think is fairly, that other comics don't use as much anymore. And I think it's a shame.
Okay, and I definitely, reading through it, it felt like you said, almost a throwback in that sense where very text-heavy and dialogue-heavy, but it's very clear, like, you could tell it was a clear and conscious choice where, because there's so much text and lettering on the page, it never actually, like, interferes with the art, or you're still very good at emoting characters in facial expression. Like, everything is still there, but, like you said, at the same time, there's quite a bit of visual dialogue happening, but there's actual, like, story and text-heavy, like, it's such a, I think, a tight rope to walk. And like you said, looking back at Silver Age and Golden Age stuff, you can kind of see where that line is. And like I said, I reading it, I was picking that up specifically, like, because I think there's a tough, and I think when you see wordy comics nowadays, there's an instance where it might infringe on the art, but there's a science to kind of managing both. And I think it's tough to do. And I think you did it well with Wolf's Head.
Oh, right on. That's great to hear. I actually have. It's kind of funny. I actually have, like, I sort of created it myself. It's like a lettering and panel guideline. And it's pretty straightforward of just sort of quick calculations of how many panels is on this particular page. Okay, I know I can do about 210 to 230 words on a page. So based on some different guidelines, and I found stuff from like Will Eisner to Jim Shooter, you know, to different people. So you get a sense of how many balloons can you have per panel and how many words in a particular balloon before things start to feel too heavy and too dense, like in a really negative way. So I use those things as a guideline, just as a guideline. It's not like a hard and fast rule, but just as a guideline to get a sense of, oh, you know, this actually, the way I wrote this originally, can I simplify this line of dialogue a little bit? And Sam, my editor, is my wife, and she's a professional editor, is a great help with me on that because she'll also sort of watch for that and sort of help me sometimes just sort of rework a sentence or rework, you know, a scene just to be like, can you narrow it down a little bit, or vice versa? Can you expand it out a little bit just so there's like a rhythm happening with each, you know, almost right down to the balloons, but really on a panel and page basis. So things are, they both make sense and are clear without feeling heavy. And honestly, I was terrified of, you know, being like either too text heavy or too expository that people would be like, yeah, I get it. Okay, I got it. Thank you. Got it. Thank you. Shut the fuck up. Thank you. You know, and I honestly looked at people like Jim Shooter is another one in the 80s where, you know, he can be a contentious figure. But if one goes to his website, jimshooter.com, there's all kinds of resources of his storytelling philosophy and whatnot, and you can learn a lot from it. You don't have to agree with everything, but there's a lot there to learn. And he was editor-in-chief at Marvel for a reason. I mean, it's like there's a lot to learn.
So you briefly mentioned the documentary earlier. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. This was kind of wild. So there's a filmmaker named Megan Dernford. She's in Montreal here in Quebec. And she basically tracked me down just through online research, I guess. So I got an email in, I think, 2015, just out of the blue from her, talking about this project that she was interested in doing. And I'll get to that in just a sec. And that led to eventual phone calls and whatnot. And then, you know, and I kept on thinking this film will never get made, you know, whatever, but, you know, it's kind of interesting. And lo and behold, the film was, you know, was made and, you know, is out now. What her research interest was dealing, like sort of finding kids even if they're adults now, but children who had grown up with parents that battled mental illness, any mental illness, but that had just been, you know, dealing with it. And of course, in my case, my mom, who died at 48, she died quite young, was diagnosed schizophrenic when I was pretty young and was in and out of hospitals. You know, she had what are called nervous breakdowns and, you know, she was hospitalized a lot. And my memory of my mom, you know, is a very loving woman, but a very troubled woman. And part of the first graphic novel I did, Road to God Knows, even though it's fictional, dealt with a lot of my own experiences growing up with in a household like that. And we were very poor. I was a welfare kid, you know. And then just sort of dealing with the confusion. Sometimes it could be very scary, but it was more the confusion and the uncertainty of something like schizophrenia when, as a kid, especially when you're like 10 or 11 or what have you, you don't understand what's happening. And even though things get sort of less scary as time goes on, because as a kid, you're getting older, so you're getting more experienced, and also you're going through these experiences, in my case with my mom, but those experiences sort of help prepare you so that, you know, when my mom would have episodes, you know, the first few, very scary. Later on, not as scary, even though they could still be just as confusing because I got a better handle on it. So Megan wanted to do a film dealing with kids like me. And, you know, she was doing sort of, it started off as doing research. And then I was just amazed. She was able to get funding. She was able to find other subjects. And eventually the film, and it's called I Am Still Your Child, was made. It's about 45 minutes long. So it's not like a feature-length documentary, but it's, you know, with commercials and what have you. It's an hour for television. And she was able to get funding through the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, or the CBC, kind of like NPR in the States. Crown Corporation, or you know, it's state-funded, government-funded company, and they were able to finish the film. And you know, it started airing about a year and a half ago or so, maybe 2 years now, across Canada. I think it might be geo-locked. I'm not sure if people around the world can see it yet.
Yeah, I tried to watch it. It was geo-locked, but
yeah. You know what? I might be able to work that out. Just give me some, you know, off interview time, and I'll see what I can do. get you guys a screener or whatever. But I mean, like, I'm biased because I'm in it. But it was, I was terrified. So how to say this? Like, when I make comics, I have obviously a lot of editorial control and what have you, and what I'm writing and drawing. This was a unique experience for me because I'm just the subject. I had no control in it. I didn't even know the other people involved, and I certainly had no editing control. So when I was first, when I first saw the finished film, and there was like, it was at a theater, so there were like 80 people in attendance, sort of like friends and family and whatnot. I was terrified. I was actually having like full on flop sweat going, what if this is like a hatchet job? Or what if this is just not like, not what I hope it is? And, you know, it turned out all my fears were unwarranted. You know, it's the kind of thing you just, or at least I get nervous about. But I thought they did a really sensitive job of showing, you know, there's the film focuses on three of us. So there are two other young women, Sarah and Jessie, who are more at the time of the film going through stuff now. Like Sarah was a teenager. She was like 15 when the film was done, and Jessie was just into university. And so they're dealing with parents that are struggling. And then, you know, as young women, they're struggling as well, trying to figure out what they're going to do in life and sort of figure out just, you know, day-to-day living in the face of this. My stuff was more because my mom had been dead since, you know, my mom died in 1994, so she had been dead quite some time. Mine was more like, you know, this is a guy who sort of came out the other end, and there's some sadness with his story, but I was there. My role in the film is sort of as not as a counterpoint, but just sort of as like a different perspective on this sort of parental mental illness thing. And the way the film sort of cross-cuts the narrative and what have you between us, I was blown away. I mean, I was amazed to see, for people who did not know each other at all, and for people in slightly different age groups, some of the commonalities of experiences, even though the diagnoses were different, really surprised me. So we all make art in different ways. Dogs all played a significant role in our lives, much more than I ever thought they would. So there were like things like that, plus, you know, love and communication and whatnot, that sort of showed a bonds of not just family, but sort of bonds of connection, even between people who hadn't met. And since the film, I've gotten to know the other participants of it, like in the film, Sarah and Jesse and their families. But at the time, I had no idea. So, yeah, I mean, it's a heavy film in the positive sense. Like, it is an emotional film. And it is, you know, for me, it's weird because it was so much of me just talking about my own life and whatnot that part of it I didn't find, you know, very difficult. But talking with other people who have seen it, I'm sort of moved by how moved they were, as people found it and have found it a very emotional film. So, yeah, it was a really neat, interesting, very emotional, very emotional. I don't think I can express how it was like. I mean, just as a quick like side note, like because I don't know anything about film, as it turns out in a documentary, they use something that's, they sort of refer to it as a 100-to-1 ratio. And what that means is for every minute of film, every 1 minute of film that's actually in the finished documentary, they shoot 100 minutes.
Wow.
So they shot, I don't know, like 12 hours of footage with me, like something like that. It was just a ridiculous amount of film that did not actually get into the final, you know, final film. But they were here, like, in my home, in my studio and stuff like that, and then sort of wandering around the neighborhood sometimes. And it's just, you know, they would come, they did it for 2 full days. And when it's done, you're like, I can go to bed. I need a stiff drink, and I'm going to go to bed for a while, because that's pretty intense. And I think the only other thing I found emotionally challenging with it was, when I did the graphic novel back in 2009, I had sort of said my bit and made my piece. And despite, you know, the amateurishness of the art and the storytelling and whatnot, I had sort of laid, don't want to say I laid my mom to rest, but I had sort of revisited my childhood and, you know, whatnot, and then sort of moved on. So I found it very weird to come back in 2015, 16, and even 2017 and sort of be coming back to some of this stuff. And in some ways that was pretty challenging because, you know, I had just, like, both as a visual artist, I had grown a lot stronger, you know, as a human being, I was in a different place than I was certainly when my mom was alive and when I was living with her, but also from 2009 when I had explored a lot of this stuff. So I had had some initial hesitations about participating in it over things like that, but honestly, as it turns out, it was such a wonderful experience. I'm really, really glad I was able to be a part of it.
Yeah, it looks, I mean, really fantastic. And I watched as much as you could on YouTube and tracked down other clips and interviews. And like I said, one of the really interesting things was about it was kind of all three of you found a creative outlet in some way. I think it was Jess was the other painter, I believe,
yep.
in it.
Yep.
And then... Sarah with music. And do you think something for you who self-taught in comics and have kind of built yourself in that way, do you think something like that in your life kind of allowed you to have that outlet for emotions and also a little bit of, like, I know you talk about control in it, and I've people talk about kind of having that control of the narrative and the emotions. Is this something that you see a clear line as to, like, your interest in art, or is it something that kind of helped you in a way?
Yeah, I've actually thought about this because there are interesting questions that come up that I can't answer. So I'll frame it. I was a poor kid with a single mom. My dad was around, but, you know, it wasn't like he was wealthy or anything like that either. So I didn't have a great relationship with him. but, and I was an only child. So I found a lot of escape from sort of the trials and tribulations of my mom and what have you in things like comics and in, you know, things like Star Trek and role-playing games and, you know, books and sci-fi and fantasy and what have you. So I escaped into my bedroom a lot as a kid. But a lot of my own experiences, and it's an interesting question. I have no idea how much of this is my own personality, particularly when I was a kid or not, but I was monumentally insecure. So the one thing I knew as a kid was that I could not draw. And I thought maybe later on, like when I was a teenager, like late teens and stuff, I was like, maybe I could write, but there's no way in hell I could draw because I know what artists are. Artists are hit by magic wands. And I'm not really kidding, you know, they're hit by magic wands when they come out of the womb, and by the time they could toddle, they have crayons in their hands, and they know they can draw. They just know it. And they figure stuff out. And, you know, when you hear a lot of, like even in comics, when you hear a lot of interviews, that actually is something that, not quite to that extent, obviously, but a lot of times you'll hear an artist and be like, oh yeah, I drew when I was like six, so, you know, and I had art going and comics and stuff, and you know, Alex Ross, you know, whatever, like you hear a lot of these stories about people who are drawing really, really young. That was not me. I, you know, I did a little bit like any kid does, but I gave up when, you know, I was around 9 or 10, and it wasn't like I was serious before that. And a lot of it was, I had no confidence whatsoever in this. I just knew I loved comics. And comics for a poor kid at that time, and I'm talking 80s primarily, they were fairly cheap. They had gone up in price, but I mean, for somebody like me, I was able to, you know, hit the comic shop and get some X-Men comics or whatever, and even go into the back issue bins for, you know, a buck or two and come out with a nice little haul. And, you know, obviously that's not quite the case now when you compare prices to minimum wage, you know, like in the States or what have you, but it's, so I found a lot of escape, but I never thought I could do it. Now, if my mom had been healthy and if we had had more financial stability, because my mom was actually really, really smart. She was a teacher before things fell apart for her. She had actually gone back to Carleton University here in Ottawa and got a BA in psychology. And I am still astounded that she was able to do that, because she did it when she, in many ways, was at her worst. And the courage it took for her to do some of this stuff just blows my mind now as an adult. I wasn't aware of it as a kid. It was just mom doing mom things. But as an adult, I'm sort of, you know, just stunned by some of the things that she was able to do. But things got worse for her. And my memory of her is there is a decline. So what if that hadn't happened? What if she was not schizophrenic? And what if she had been healthy, normal, quote unquote normal, had a good job, you know, and all that stuff, did the things that she liked to do? Would I have had more self-confidence? There might have been more money, but would I have had more self-confidence to learn to draw earlier? I don't know. I kind of wish I had done it, because, you know, my learning curve, learning to draw is not, it, you know, it is really not something that is impossible for anyone. You know, people talk about talent a lot. I tend to view talent as hard work and determination and the sort of the right self-esteem to be able to fail and then learn from your failure and not be crushed by it. But there's also a financial component to it as well, because you need to have the financial security, you know, to be able to put the time in to do it. And one of my immense frustrations about the austerity times we live in is how many people who might have been awesome artists, you know, awesome storytellers, even writers, you know, any type of thing, actors, you name it, won't have the opportunity because they simply can't afford it, that they don't have the sort of the grounding to do it. So in my case, who knows, you know, maybe I would have been 15 years ahead of where I am now if, you know, if my childhood had been different. what happened really was that after my mom died, I wound up working in bookstores, not being paid very much, and I started meeting authors. And I realized that writing, like any art, again, it's the talent thing, is hard work with a lot of false starts and a lot of reversals and a lot of failures. And I started to sort of rethink my love of comics and my love of visual art and whatnot. And I literally sat down with a copy of a book called Drawing on the Right Side of Your Brain by Betty Edwards. And I started to teach myself to draw. And it's basically never stopped from then. And I mean, I was awful. Like, it's, you know, I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Is like, I failed a lot, you know. I mean, the idea is suck and suck less. The idea is fail and fail better. You know, like, you do get stronger as time goes on. But the riddle to it, and sometimes the you know, it's the frustration of life in many ways, is not just art, is you don't know what, you can't even see, you know, the goal line or the end zone or the finish line or what have you. Is you don't know how long it's going to take you to get strong. And some people it goes faster, and other people, in my case, it went pretty slow. So it brings up another question, is would I have even started to learn to draw if I had known it would take about 20 years to actually get to the point where I can consider myself like a halfway decent artist? I don't know. I honestly don't know if I had known back in the late 90s when I started this crazy journey, if it would have, it would take this long. I don't know if I would have started it, because it's, there's a lot of sacrifices you have to make in your personal life to do it. And honestly, and you know, it's important to say this, my wife and I have been together for since 1996. So if it wasn't for her continual support, I don't know if I would have been able to do it. And I don't just mean emotional support, which she is amazing for that, but I also mean the financial support. Because to put the time in, you know, without her support, I don't know if, you know, I mean, I was doing it when I was back at the bookstore, and I took on, for years, I was a superintendent at our little apartment building near a university, basically so we could live with really dramatically reduced rent. So instead of having to, you know, do a lot of outside work, I could do, you know, sort of a superintendent gig, which allowed me to play with my hours more so I could keep learning to draw. But it was, you know, without her support, I don't know if I would have been able to do it either. So, you know, it is what it is, but it's a tricky, you know, all of this kind of thing is, it's, there's no rule book, there's no textbook, there's no, like I said, there's no finish line in sight. You just do it, and you hopefully you keep enjoying doing it. And then the only last thing, I've talked a lot, I'm sorry, but the only other thing I can say to it is, it's learning to draw has never affected my love for the medium. I still love comics. I mean, I can get frustrated with them like anybody else, both on the business side of it and sometimes what I think of as, you know, different, maybe not so great art practices and what have you. Like I said, the aforementioned, you know, how few words are used now, how few panels are used now to tell a story, but the waiting for the trade thing and whatnot too. But I still love comics. And there was a few grim times where I was like, this learning to draw thing is killing me. And it's also sapping my enthusiasm for comics in general. And those were kind of fallow periods, but they didn't last all that long. And yeah, I still love comics. They're great.
I mean, you talked about the your kind of growth as an artist, but I imagine, especially on something like Wolf's Edge, expanding the series out, and you've talked about like 10 issues in at this point, was there a challenge from you in that perspective of fleshing a story out that long? Has it been a learning, or how has pacing been versus like kind of previously, either in shorter stories or, you know, contained graphic novel type scenarios? I mean, even having read the first 4 issues, I think they're well paced, and having read the issue or the end of issue 4, like, I'm fucking so excited to see kind of where you go from there. I don't spoil anything, but like,
But like the idea of that then pacing out like another six issues seems exciting to kind of read. How has it been approached as a writer in that sense, kind of knowing how to pace a larger narrative?
So I mean, there has been a learning curve, but this has been part of the great amount of fun I've had with it. Is, you know, one of the things I wanted to do is see. So, you know, with a graphic novel, obviously, beginning, middle, end for the most part. I mean, you know, yes, there are serialized graphic novels that are, you know, 10 volumes in length. But just to put those aside and go like a standalone graphic novel with a beginning, middle, end story, like Road was about 148 pages long. So, you know, you sort of write it with that in mind, you know, or certainly draw it with that in mind. And, you know, you sort of know what you're getting into. With Wolf's Head, in some ways, the most freeing thing is I'm sort of doing it an issue at a time. Now, I got to be careful because I do, and I'm not against them in principle, there are sort of loose arcs, story arcs that I use to sort of connect, you know, in like in Wolf's Head's case, the first six issues do form a story arc, and then the next four issues also form a story arc. But what I really wanted to do, and the first two issues are a bit of an exception to what I'm about to say, because it's sort of the first issue ends on a bit of a cliffhanger, but I also really wanted to see within that framework if I could get back to one of the things I love about comics is telling beginning, middle, end stories inside like an individual issue, but have that individual issue continue to lead to the larger story arc and larger sort of narrative directions that the characters go through. So again, it's very difficult for me to judge that, but I really wanted to try to go, okay, I've got 20 pages. What do I want to say in 20 pages? You know, in Lauren's case, like, where is Lauren at? Where was she last issue? Okay, what is she trying to accomplish this issue? Okay, make sure that's clear. What are the obstacles to what she's, you know, and then you sort of go through that process. And I try to do that for every single issue so that every issue has, again, except for the like sort of the first two, because they were a little bit different, has this, at least to my mind, a beginning, middle, end, so that the reader hopefully, if when they finish an issue, are satisfied and want to know what happens next. And honestly, if I've done my job, and I've tested this a little bit with people, where I've started people not at issue one, but at like issue seven, and going like, okay, so you haven't read the first six issues, let's just start you with this one. Can you, like, do you know who Lauren is? Do you know what she's trying to do? Do you, like, you don't necessarily know the whole backstory, but you don't need to know the whole backstory. You need to know, you know, who is she? What does she want? Like, are her motivations clear? What are the obstacles to it? And how does it all work out? And that's been my massively sort of overarching kind of goal as a writer doing it. And one of the things that it does, so it takes work to you know, sort of break the story and work on that to the point that you actually have a story that you could then go and draw. But it's actually not only more satisfying to me as a writer to do it this way, but you don't have the problems that like a long-form graphic novel can give you, where like that's a lot of content. Like 148 pages or whatever, however many pages, like there's a lot there, and there's, you have to do a number of things to make sure, you know, it doesn't lag and that you're sort of peaking at the right times. Where one of the beautiful things about sort of Western style, North American style comics is the periodical format of them gives, a way of doing closure that's different than like a novel or a graphic novel. And when I was doing research on this, and this goes back a few years ago, the guy I actually looked at wasn't a comic guy. It was Charles Dickens. Because when Charles Dickens was doing his, sort of before, and, you know, even when he became like uber famous, and I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think of how many people were reading his work. But in something like his early stuff, like the Pickwick Papers, he that was done, if memory serves, in I think 20 or 22 installments or issues. And they were literally distributed like issues, and like around 40 pages long. And it was a bit scholarly, like academic, but I was doing some reading on some of the research people have done on the Pickwick Papers, and I was uncovering things like Dickens would write for the overall arcing sort of story of what the Pickwick Papers would be, but he was also trying to make sure that each individual issue had closure, had like a beginning, middle, and an end. And I was like, yeah, that's comics. That's exactly it, you know. And that's also, of course, what people like Jim Shooter, let alone, you know, people like Stan Lee and Ditko and what have you, also talked about is, you know, is this, you know, this comic that you're holding in your hands, is it giving you a beginning, middle, end, at least an end to a part of the problem, like a beginning, middle, end of, you know, a story that you can go, you can sort of identify, you know, these type of story questions. Who's the main character? What do they want? You know, what are the obstacles? Yada, yada, yada. And you can, you can sort of, you, in a way, you can test out your own writing. You can sort of stress test it to see what you, you know, as best as, you know, like an inherently biased person can do, to sort of figure this stuff out. And it was fascinating to me to come across people like Dickens who had thought about it. And one of the things that's like sort of fascinating to me about comics sort of broadly, the, you know, the direct market, is how rare that seems to be now versus how ubiquitous it was back in the day, and how it, like, people, I don't know how to describe it. I'm going to use cliches a bit, but it almost seems like people are like kind of frou-frou, like, you know, less is more, and I want the visual art to, you know, to tell the story, and I don't want to use words, and we want to have as few words as possible, and a lot of panel, like, very big panel images, but not very many panels on a page, and, you know, man, like, for me, that's, I'm just not interested in that. I really am not. And, I mean, because it's an art form, you always have to be careful, because it's just tools. There are no rules. There's no right way to do it. There's only, you know, your way, but at least for my own sensibilities, what I've been trying to do with Wolf's Head sort of more closely meshes my own thinking of what I like about comics. And I've just found it remarkably freeing as a writer to approach the narrative this way. It's not that it's not work. It is work. It's, you know, it's not like, you know, digging a ditch or anything like that, but it is, it can be challenging, and there, you know, there are frustrations with it, but man, it's a lot of fun too.
Yeah, and obviously I think that's what's so interesting about the medium is it's one, obviously, where there's so many different approaches, but even within, you know, an issue, you know, sometimes you have different approaches within the team. You have a writer who can take one approach, you know, an artist, a colorer, a letterer. Like, there's, everyone has this kind of distinct view of the medium, and there's so many different approaches to it, so it's nice to see kind of everyone have the ability, or at least I think now kind of a broader voice of people doing their own kind of things versus kind of what we've seen with the big two. Because I think at that, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to say it. From what I've read, I've fallen off a lot. I used to, you know, spend $100 a week on it, but there is very much in the sense of kind of like the main 12 titles they have, which read similar, but I don't know. I don't really get into. I don't know.
No, I'm with you. I'll read.
Yeah, go ahead.
Like, I've been bored for the most part, and again, you know, you have to be careful, because this does not mean that there aren't individual issues that are exceptional, or, you know, individual story arcs, or creative teams, or individual creators that aren't great. You know, there are, but in terms of sort of the day-to-day, particularly corporate comics and corporate intellectual property, I don't have a lot of interest. And I, you know, one of the things about, so I said earlier, like, my love for the medium is still as strong as ever, and that's true. However, when you do learn, you know, you start making comics and you sort of get more into the business side of it, and, you know, certainly my background in bookstores and whatnot as well, you know, it's hard not to sour a little bit on some of the business stuff. And I know a big part for me, just as a fan, was how Marvel treated Chris Claremont back in the early 90s, I think, when he was just sort of unceremoniously cast aside after doing his, 17-year stint on the X-Men. And I was kind of like, that's bullshit. Like, that's, you didn't even get a proper send-off. Like, for Christ's sakes, I mean, I understand if you want to, you know, you want to go in a different direction, like, fine, whatever, but, you know, do it with some class. And, you know, it was things like that that kind of, you know, and it wasn't only that, but it was things like that that just soured me on it. But I also always had, like, it was weird as a kid, and I'm just, I don't know if I was luckier maybe than others, is we had a comic book shop here that carried Marvel and DC stuff, of course, but they also carried First Comics and Eclipse and, you know, a lot of independents, a lot of black and whites and Dark Horse, you know, back before Dark Horse really, you know, became what it is now. And they just carry different things. And I was able, even when I was a pretty young kid, to come across, you know, I would buy X-Men, but I would buy other things. And it just exposed me as a reader to, you know, a lot of different things. So I was never like, you know, the stereotypical Marvel zombie or whatever. Is I liked Marvel, for sure, but I didn't buy all the stuff. I couldn't afford to buy all the stuff to start off with, but I didn't have interest in every single thing Marvel was putting out or DC was putting out. And I also still vividly remember when I started to twig to the fact that they were reaching into my wallet deliberately. And it was Evolutionary War and Atlantis Attacks, those two big crossovers where I was like, that's it, I'm done, screw this, you know, this isn't, like, I don't care, and I collected it for some reason. And then the other one that got me as a fan, and it's geeky, but I loved Alpha Flight. I was a Canadian kid, and John Byrne, you know, was amazing to me. And Alpha Flight, his Alpha Flight, I still, as an adult, I still really like them. And when he left, I kept collecting that damn series for something like 80 issues, hoping it would reclaim, you know, sort of regain what it had. And it never did. It never did. And I finally gave up around, I don't know, issue 100, issue 95 or whatever, where I was like, it's never coming back. Screw this. What am I doing? And, you know, it's the industry can be tough. And it's sort of fascinating right now to watch what's happening with the industry, because it's hard to know, you know, if we're seeing like a new stage of distributor wars, or if this is just an exceptional time that, you know, everything will go back to Diamond dominating the direct market, you know, whenever, you know, the pandemic is over. And it's just, it's kind of fascinating to look at. And, you know, not knowing where things are going to go is sort of scary on the one hand, but kind of exciting on the other.
Yeah, so I always find that, like, so many people have, I want to say similar stories, but I've obviously, being someone who does quote unquote comics press and has done, you know, a comic book podcast and interviews for like 7 years now, I'll run into a lot of like similar stories of the, like, there's a moment where, you know, I was, again, buying, you know, every Marvel book. Like, well, I grew up, you know, huge Marvel fan, but kind of afraid. I was like, social anxiety of going into a comic book store, like, not know, I don't like to go in a place where I don't know what I'm doing, so like I get very nervous. So I would just buy like what I could find, and I would buy things. But I remember, like, specifically, like, freshman year of college, someone handing me Klaus's, like, A Velvet Glove Cast in Iron.
Yeah
and be like, oh, this is a fucking comic, like, this is something else. But then similarly, like, buying, I was for whatever reason, like, so excited for Secret Invasion. I thought it was gonna be like the greatest thing ever. I was like, they've been planting these seeds for years, it's gonna blow my fucking mind. So I bought all the tie-ins, and I was like, this is fucking stupid, why did I do this? Like, and I've just bought books I don't care about. And again, it hasn't, I'm still buying, like, you know, Hickman's, I enjoy Hickman's X-Men. I think, again, what he does is approach of a medium, like, long-form storytelling, but, like, again, like, the kind of realization that not only you vote with your money, but, like, stories are stories, and there's more stories to tell and more stories to read outside of kind of that mainstream pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, my thing with the big two and what have you is, I'm never going to begrudge somebody, particularly, you know, in this day and age, if they get a little sliver of happiness reading Spider-Man or the X-Men or Batman or whatever. What I wish sometimes is sort of the stereotype, and I'm not even sure how accurate the stereotype is, but the stereotype of a fanboy, you know, you just break out of it every now and then. Like, keep buying your Batman books or whatever, but try something different. You know, try something that you don't know. And, I mean, it is harder now because even periodical comics are so expensive. But if you, you know, you don't know what is out there until you sort of dip your toes in it and try. And, I mean, odds are you're going to come across things you don't like. But at the same time, you will find things you do like. And I don't know, like back, like from the bookstore point of view, and it was, I worked at a general bookstore, so I was the manager. I did like all the buying for it and whatnot. You know, I tried to even do things back then was, you know, yes, we're going to buy the best sellers and, you know, whatever the, you know, in our case, like the big award winners and whatnot. But we always tried, and I always tried to find first-time authors or lesser-known authors, lesser-known presses and whatnot to sort of showcase different styles of writing, because there's a lot out there aside from, you know, kind of like the airport bookstore stereotype of, you know, what a bookstore can be, or a big chain bookstore that just has stacks and stacks of the new Stephen King or whatever. And again, I mean, if somebody gets pleasure out of that, I'm not going to begrudge them for it, but it's just fun. I think it's fun and healthy to try different things, experiment a little bit and see what's out there. And, you know, you won't like everything, but it is neat to, you know, come across things that you do fall in love with. And, you know, that's, I'm always, you know, it tickles me in a way that's hard to put into words. But I'll give you a very, very good recent example. And this is actually a 60s comic, so I actually was not that familiar with it. I was vaguely aware of the publisher American Comics Group, ACG, back in the newsstand days. But they published a comic called Herbie. And it is one of the, it's a little dated, but it is one of the most sublime and hilarious comics I've come across. And what's funny is all the issues are on archive.org. Because I gather they're either copyright free or whoever has done them, you know, has not squashed the copyright infringement. I'm not exactly clear on the legality of it, but they're there and they've been there for a while. And I was just reading the digital versions of them and they're awesome. Like, they are delightful. And there's actually a lot to learn from a writer, as a writer, on, you know, some of what they were doing with dialogue. But, and then it turns out, and I came across this afterwards when I was doing a bit of research on it, it's Alan Moore's favorite comic. And wow. I was like, what? How the hell do I not know about this? And it's, you know, I can send you links. Like, they are, you know, it is an acquired taste, probably. There is a little bit of racism and what have you. There are a few things that don't work now that were okay in the 60s, but not really any different than what Marvel and DC sort of did sometimes. But they are really, really funny in a very, very dry way. And I was just, you know, if you only stick to contemporary comics, and if you only stick to, you know, big two comics, you never even get an opportunity to try some of that stuff. And it's been one of the nicer discoveries for me just as a reader than that I've had in the last few years. Just delightful stuff, really fun.
Yeah, and I work a few hours a week at a Barnes & Noble just for the discount to buy stuff. And the store manager hasn't caught on yet, but what I'll do is I place like orders, like ship to store orders.
Yeah.
For books that I want us to carry that we don't. And I just don't pick them up because I'm the employee. So I just cancel the order once it comes in. So then we stock it because awesome. We have it. So we have to put it on the shelf. So we have like a shitload of like random comics and graphic novels that we wouldn't normally carry. Like just placed like a bunch for Copra. I was like, Kyle, why are you buying like three things of Copra? And I was like, oh, I'll get them. And then when they come in, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to get them. I don't need them. Never mind.
Love it. That's awesome. I actually did something similar, but in like, so I did all the buying. So I could just order, you know, the owners gave me fairly wide latitude. So that was good. But I did the sort of the opposite of that is we were a bookstore account. But back in the day when Cold Cut distribution was around, I set up an account with Cold Cut so I could order comics both for me and the store. Nice. So we had stuff that, because we didn't have a Diamond account, but, and we were only a small store. It was like 1,100 square feet, but I was able to carry some of these like graphic novels and stuff that even some of the comic shops in town didn't have just because I had a Cold Cut account. Plus, I was able to buy really cool independent comics at wholesale prices for me personally. It was great.
Shit. That would be awesome. Yeah, I wish we still carried comics. Although I see when they come in, or they used to come in like real busted, so. But
yeah.
Before we get to Tim's last question, I guess leading into that, if people wanted to find your stuff or get your specific stuff, what would be the best way they could do that?
The easiest way is my main website is vonallan.com. So VonAllan.com. And like, there's links to everything there, including Comixology and what have you. And, you know, you can buy Wolf's Head in print as well. We didn't, I don't know how much you want to get into it, it's probably too late now, but yeah, I was trying to get Wolf's Head in with Diamond. I actually have a Diamond vendor account because they carried one of my previous graphic novels, Stargazer, but my sales rep, this is where I love the direct market, and I love in irritation, you know, in quotes this way, is my sales rep left. I think he joined Dynamite. And my new rep is awful. So I've been fighting for basically 2 years to get Diamond to carry Wolf's Head. And they're not saying no. It's just completely non-committal. They never say yes. So, you know, you kind of bang your head against the wall because I don't understand what the problem is. But, what sort of saved the series in a way before, like, because Comixology is so recent, what saved the series was sort of the online distribution world that places like Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, plus independent bookstores through things like IndieBound allow, you know, comics and graphic novels to be sold. And I had set up Wolf's Head to have full ISBNs and barcodes and what have you right from the get-go. So getting my stuff into those online retailers has been really, really easy. Far easier than getting it into the direct market through Diamond. And I don't have an answer for why this is, but I've just been kind of going with the flow and, you know, trying to adapt to it as best I can.
No, that sounds like the general
hell,
setup for
Hell is what it Diamond. Is. Hell.
Yeah. And that's always something that it has continually seemed frustrating on an end where there is a market for people to want to buy books and a essentially company that distributes it, and there's no easy way to get one to the other. Like the fact that I could go into my store and ask if they could carry it, and they say, you know, they can't, or they can't get a hold of their Diamond rep, or it's fucking yeah. Insanity that was a thing, and apparently will still be a thing at some, who knows, but
hopefully yeah. It all changes.
Well, it's really tough to know right now because DC's move with, what are they, Lunar and UCS?
Yeah.
They're so linked to DCBS and Midtown Comics. Like, I'm having a really hard time imagining that Mile High Comics or Lone Star Comics would be really bloody happy ordering from a competing retailer. Like, yeah. I'm having a really hard time seeing that. So the idea of having more distributors in the direct market, I would like happily champion. I actually, because we've known, like my wife and I have known retailers, not only my own experience like in books, but theirs, they still remember, a lot of the older retailers, of course, remember when Capital City was there, Styx Distribution, Andromeda, you know, like on and on and on. We used to have like something like 13 different distributors in the direct market, and Diamond was one of many, not just the single one. And I don't really blame Diamond for how the distributor wars in the 90s, you know, fell out. They took advantage of a market situation, and if they hadn't, somebody else would have. But when you're in that position, there are certain responsibilities that I think, now, you know, I'm probably wishing on high when I say this, but one would hope that they sort of take a more active responsibility for than I think maybe they actually do. But, you know, regardless of that, more distributors would be great, but DC's moves are, at least from my point of view, very confusing, and there's questions I have that I just would love to see answered. I'm not seeing them. For instance, would this have happened even if the pandemic did not happen? Like, in other words, was this planned months ago and they just either fast-tracked it or went ahead with it anyway, or is this like brand new ground only because of the pandemic? And sort of regardless, because of the pandemic, is this going to be just a short-term thing, or is this going to be an actual long-term thing? And how does that work in practice? And what about, you know, Marvel? What about Dark Horse and Image? Like, what happens? We, you know, they're brokered publishers, so they have very specific relationships with Diamond that are different than somebody like me has with Diamond. And it feels so haphazard, you know, again, as an outsider looking in, I'm not sure how this will go. And I'm not sure this was DC's, you know, you got to be careful because there are presumably smarter people than I am figuring this stuff out. But I really kind of go, if Diamond was telling them a couple of weeks ago that they were planning on being back in business in the end of May, early June, then why do this at all? Like, why not wait? And is it because they sensed a market opportunity? Like, they're huge, but did they sense an opportunity to maybe put the squeeze on Marvel? Like, I can't figure this out. So again, you know, we'll find out how it plays out, but I would love to see Diamond have more competition. I'm just not sure this is the right way to go.
Yeah, I was thinking that because I spend a lot of my money now on trades and omnibuses and stuff like that as a collector. And generally, I will get that through in-stock trades. I will buy singles at the store. But because in-stock trades is through DCBS, generally, if you buy it the week it comes out, it's 50% off. So, like, I can get a, you know, $125 omnibus for $75, which is great. Yeah. But if the distributing is coming through there, like, how does a regular store compete? Which seems, again, there's a lot to parse there that I don't think has come out yet.
No. And I mean, we may never know. Like, depending on how it plays out, it's possible we'll never be privy to exactly what was going on with the decision makers and the powers that be. But, you know, speaking as a former retailer, the idea of my purchases for the store going through a competing retailer is just anathema. Like, that's, and I'm not even sure, you know, you sort of, when you kind of squint at it sideways, like, you start to get into trade questions, like legal questions of, you know, what are the legalities of some of this stuff? Because there's a lot of proprietary information that would be going through that, you know, you would expect it as a quote unquote distributor, but if it's like a distributor that's an arm of a retailer, like a competing retailer, that's just weird. And I mean there are other periodical distributors that presumably might have been able to step up, but if DC was really concerned about, they wanted to work with people who know comics really well. And I get it. I mean, I do get that. But if they really, really wanted to work with, you know, somebody who knew comics, you think there could still be a different way to go than this. But who knows?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it will all... No, I don't know. I will lead into Tim's question to lighten the mood, but I don't think it was.
Yeah. while we're already on a downer. So, gun to your head, Vaughn. Yep. If you had to write one episode of The Big Bang Theory, what would happen?
Oh my god, I'd end the fucking show. Are you kidding me? I hate that show. I hate that show with a passion. I never last. I watched like a couple of episodes, so no. I'd kill all the main characters. I don't even know who they are. I'd kill them all.
That's actually the most popular answer.
Yes? Okay. I couldn't believe it. I was stupefied when I saw how popular it got. But I mean, I'm like, you know, I tell you, sometimes with pop culture, I get nervous. Like, just before the pandemic hit, I was watching, at a friend's place, the new Picard television show. And I was like, this is an abomination. I don't know what this is, but this is not Roddenberry's Star Trek. This is awful. It's just awful. It's everything, that I would argue that something like, you know, the best of Roddenberry's Star Trek, both the original series and Next Generation, stood for. And then, you know, you go online and reviewers are, you know, applauding it as the greatest thing ever and the long-form storytelling is great. And I'm like, the critique is not for or against long-form storytelling. The critique is it's anathema to what Roddenberry's vision of the future was. Like, I don't know if either of you have seen it, but it's awful. And I was very pleased to see that Red Letter Media was beating the crap out of that show. And I think they're going to do a Plinkett review coming up of it, too. And I was amazed when I was seeing all the celebration for it going, okay, I don't get it. And The Big Bang Theory was the same. It's like, I don't get it at all. I am stunned that this show was popular.
Yeah, I don't. It seems like, again, the it's a question of if it's, even with like Big Bang Theory, is it, I don't know, is it, I feel like kind of with Picard as well, like, it could it be praised for it telling a good story? Sure. Is it Star Trek?
No,
probably not. Like, so it's no. Kind of with Big Bang Theory. Is it a sitcom? Sure. Is it like the best parts of like quote unquote like geek nerd culture? Doesn't seem like it. But yeah, I don't know. But that's general. I enjoy that for this when we brought back the show and kind of co-host with Tim. Now I used to ask a question that was jokingly polarizing, and we only ever had like one opposite answer, and now we've picked a question that's generally everyone just like, oh, that should.
Yeah, well, it's funny, like, again, I don't, you know, I'll never begrudge somebody liking something or having a guilty pleasure or just for out and out liking something, you know, be damned, like, who cares what other people think, I just like it and whatever, like, I don't care. You know, more power to you. I just get amazed sometimes when, you know, certain things kind of shoot up to the top like that. And that's when I start to go, okay, this is more than a guilty pleasure. So I'm either profoundly misunderstanding something or the humor in that just doesn't land for me. Like, I, you know what I mean? I have a quirky sense of humor, so I know that. But it's like, there's a lot of, you know, I mean, I could certainly pick on other things where I'm just like, I don't get why this is popular. And the only thing I find sort of fascinating about it is it actually makes me kind of queasy because there is that sort of nervousness around, I don't understand why people like this. Is there something wrong with me for not getting it? So, you know, and it's like, yeah, at the end of the day, it's also okay not to like things. But yeah, Big Bang and Picard, that was one of the more profoundly disappointing viewing experiences I've had recently, where I watched that kind of looking forward to it, kind of hoping bringing Patrick Stewart back and whatnot, this might be kind of magical. And, you know, they had, what's his face there? Chabon, how do you say his name? The Pulitzer Prize writer, winner guy, Cavalier and Clay, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, maybe this is going to be great. And I was like, if they think this is Star Trek, this is not, like, it might be fine sci-fi, which I think this is the point you were making, you know, a few minutes ago. It's like, maybe it's a good sci-fi show, but it's not Star Trek. It's not anything like the human beings. Don't want to say it's a utopia, but, you know, human beings working together, you know, to solve sort of interstellar problems and doing it in peace. Like, it's the exact opposite of that. Yeah, couldn't believe it.
But I think one thing that isn't, I guess, a question of quality is, again, Wolf's Head, and we didn't mention it, but having you sent it to us and reading it, Wizards for Hire is fucking great. I love that.
That's great.
Yeah, so definitely...
Yeah, that's actually, not to interrupt you, but that one's the polarizing one for me, is people either love it or kind of shrug their shoulders at it. You know, they don't like it. It's, you either find, like, that was specifically done to be funny. And, you know, it's a classic example that, you know, what tickles some people, it tickled me, which, you know, particularly when you're doing humor, is, I think probably the most important thing is, do you as the writer find it funny? That's kind of important. But, you know, that one, I still really like it, but, you know, it's, most people seem to really like it, but the ones who, you know, who don't are pretty strongly opinionated of it.
Yeah. That generally seems to be when people don't like things, you hear about it. I think more so when people enjoy things, you don't. And another thing I said, if we can, I'll figure out a way to post it, obviously, in the show notes, the link to the documentary. Like I said, from what I was able to watch and research from it, I found it really interesting. And something that we've discussed on the show before, I won't get into like a whole thing because, again, that's the point. But like, I've worked as a case manager for people with substance abuse and mental health, duly diagnosed. And I have a father of my own who's bipolar, and he kind of have shown up when I was in my 20s. And we've been something we've been continually dealing with. And so that aspect of having someone in the family, and again, the idea of you're being your parent and kind of dealing with that, and always been something as mine, like understanding he's my dad, but he's also a person unto his own, and where that comes into it. So I think it's an amazing idea and thing to approach and get out there. So I was really excited to see that, and I definitely think it's amazing. I enjoyed your pieces in it. So
yeah, I'll see what I can do to get you guys a screener for it.
I imagine, I don't want to obviously promote whatever you can do, which I think they sponsor most podcasts and anything else. I'm sure if you had a VPN, you could probably, I didn't try it with that, I could have.
Yes, absolutely true. Cough, cough, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, so there's ways, but quickly, I guess, Tim, where can we find you?
If there's ever comics news again, I write about it over at Comics Pit. Otherwise, I'm on Twitter, Instagram at Tim Madura.
Yeah, and if you're listening, you probably, I mean, again, for most, like we'll say most of the time, you don't stumble on comic book podcasts. It's not like other mediums, but yeah, we're at pages_panels, and our email is ourpodcastsucks@gmail.com. But I always forget to check it anyway. I use my regular email, so I'll start checking it more. But again, more importantly, go out and support Wolf's Head on Comicology now. And again, a huge thanks to Von Miller for coming on and chatting.
Thank you.
Yep, and that's this issue. And next time, we'll definitely talk about George Lopez show. cut there.
Bazinga! Bazinga! Bazinga!